had a good look at, and I don't mind, you know, at some stage we can... Yeah, we'll have a look at that today. And then there's a couple of other chapters. There's, I think, the part of chapter 17, and then there's chapters 18 and 19, consisting of the various prayers of the inhabitants of Jumper Deep, yeah. So, yeah, we'll have a look at that, the hellish planets. We'll start there, and then maybe that might help you mend your ways. Help all of us. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. King Parikit inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, "My dear sir, why are the living entities put into different material situations? Kindly explain this to me." The great sage Sukadeva Goswami said, "My dear king, in this material world there are three kinds of activities. Those in the mode of goodness, the mode of passion, and the mode of ignorance. Because all people are influenced by the three modes of material nature, the results of their activities are divided into three. One who acts in the mode of goodness is religious and happy. One who acts in passion achieves mixed misery and happiness. And one who acts under the influence of ignorance is always unhappy and lives like an animal. Because of the varying degrees to which the living entities are influenced by the different modes of nature, their destinations are also of different varieties. Just as by executing various pious activities one achieves different positions in heavenly life, by acting impiously one achieves different positions in hellish life. Those who are activated by the material mode of ignorance engage in impious activities, and according to the extent of their ignorance, they are placed in different grades of hellish life. If one acts in the mode of ignorance because of madness, his resulting misery is the least severe. One who acts impiously but knows the distinction between pious and impious activities is placed in a hell of intermediate severity. And for one who acts impiously and ignorant because of atheism, the result in hellish life is the worst. Because of ignorance, every living entity has been carried by various desires into thousands of different hellish planets since time immemorial. I shall try to describe them as far as possible." So there we see a summary of the same information that we get in the Bhagavad Gita, and of course that information about the destination of the various living entities when they leave the current material body is based upon the activities in the three modes of material nature, and that knowledge is consistent throughout all the Vedas. Yet we actually see that it's very common in Hindu philosophy in the modern age, which then travels around the world to persons influenced by Indian teachings, that generally people believe that they had no knowledge of any of this, and they tend to believe that according to your own particular desires, you are creating your own destiny. And they just have a blind faith that, in my next life maybe I'd like to become a horse, or I'd like to become a bird, or I'd like to go to heaven, or I'd like to be, I'd like to, be in the same place with my husband or wife, or, they've passed away, or, I'd like to be born in this country, or what have you. So people just believe that if they have a particular desire, even at best just a very loose faith in some saints or form of God, that's enough to achieve a particular destination. So, but actually couldn't be further from the truth. Generally, most Christians believe that just by calling themselves Christians, they will be going to heaven, that they will find Jesus. Most Muslims believe that just by calling themselves a Muslim, and engaging in certain activities, that they will be going to their heaven, greeted by the open arms of many virgins who they will enjoy. People have so many different understandings, but actually you would question that if someone is very, very religious, and just because of their faith, despite all sorts of activities, even sinful activities against their faith, that they're somehow protected by God, then you'd question, why Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Jewish people, etc., are actually living in some countries in extremely lifelong positions of suffering. See what I mean?
As a kid, I remember reading one story in Amitabha, where a person was very much attached to this treasury.
Yeah.
He had it's called faith.
Yeah.
It is always looking at that, and that's when you're trying to think about it.
Yes.
In the next life, and he's born as a cockroach.
Yes.
And goes into the pit.
That's right.
He is staying the same.
Yeah.
He is the same house, but he's
as
a cockroach.
As a cockroach, that's right. Yeah.
There's one more story about a person becoming a snake or.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And some people who are very, very attached to their wealth, they take birth as dogs. And those dogs inherit the millions of dollars of their master. So, some of the wealthiest people in the world are actually dogs. Yeah, and cats. that, you know, the master, the owner of the pet dies and they leave the whole mansion, millions of dollars, and they just leave it in the trust. So, yeah. So they're born in sometimes you get some dogs, they're born in a good Christian community and they're very wealthy, but they're a dog. So, there would seem to be for instance here, in the Bhagavad Gita, when we read about, say, the reign of Maharaj Parikit, the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, Lord Ramchandra, you sort of see how very opulent, very peaceful, not much disease, like that. If there's problems, everything is, the rule of law is very strong, rascals, dealt with instantly, like that. You sort of expect it where persons have that divine blessings of the Lord, that that is the symptom that by their God consciousness, yes, they are getting a good result. If we see, as we see in this world now, that a huge percentage of people belonging to the various mainstream religions of the world are taking birth in extremely positions of suffering, then you sort of have to question whether that blind faith is producing anything else but suffering, isn't it?
But then one could also say that those who are Krishna conscious, some of them also go to extreme suffering. Historically, you can take the example of Mother Kunti and the Pandavas. So how would you make? Because we say that just because you've become a devotee doesn't mean that all suffering will go away. In fact, Krishna will use the karma to purify you and to test you in Krishna consciousness.
So let's take Queen Kunti's situation.
Because from memory recollection, Prabhupada said that the Lord teaches the daughter by teaching the daughter law. So the Pandavas went through suffering to teach, because Krishna wanted to teach others how to turn towards Krishna in times of suffering, and how that is the real. But there are some devotees who deal with extreme suffering, like if you take Kesavasa Maharaj, on a physical level, you think he's suffering a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if you take his life as a whole, I wouldn't say it's a life of extreme suffering. He's from a reasonable situation in the Western sort of a background. It wasn't, extreme poverty or lack of education or things. And then, as a devotee, his life mostly, as a young man, is, living, preaching, dancing, chanting, prasadam, the association of nice persons, residing within temples. And then, I remember in the early 80s when I was in India, and we would go down to the bank of the Ganges with Chaitanya Maharaj, and we'd swim in the Ganges, and then we'd get out, and then Maharaj would, you know, we'd cover ourselves with mud, and Maharaj would cover himself with the mud and lay around, and the sun, let the mud dry on your body, and then, you know, very good for your skin, and then we'd go in, wash it off, and then go back to the temple, have some visharam, some kirtan, and I mean, there's certainly been some very austere conditions. I mean, everyone goes through old age, and, you know, as we get closer to old age, we have, you know, more experiences of, you know, heart problems or, you know, pain and rheumatism. So that means everyone goes through that to some degree or another. That's the usual course for most people, even in wealthy countries. Birth, death, old age and disease, even for people who live very, very good lives, you know, they still go through that. So, I mean, he has his share of that. But, and, you know, there's certainly been some, attacks and, various things. But, I mean, if you take his life as a whole, you know, there's been a lot of... you know, majority just nice days preaching, and, you know, hundreds and, you know, if not thousands of servants, you know, offering him, cooking his, you know, the best of foods, and, you know, if there is some problem, you know, dealing with that problem instantly, just, you know, never sort of neglecting any difficulties. I mean, sometimes the difficulties stand out, but actually, you know, it's compared to, you know, the adventures, the variety, the good food, the good association, you know, the like that. It's, you know, that's you know, traveling around the world, and, you know, I think most people who end up stuck in a factory or an office doing the same monotonous job, you know, I was watching a documentary the other day where these people from the West, they went to, I think it was China or something like that, or Taiwan, and there's a massive big factory, right, so there's thousands of workers. They all wear the same white things, you know, so the white sort of overall type things, and it comes up over their mouth and sort of, and their hair, you know, there's a so that, you know, basically they've got their eyes and their nose exposed and everything, and, you know, they've got the white gloves on, and their job from morning to night, you know, I mean, they get lunch and what have you, is, you know, they assemble these little wire coils and a little metal part, and then they put that down and they do it again. And they do that all day, like that. And they don't even know what the part is. And I thought to myself, you know, so these Westerners were trying that job out. Now, after 2 hours, they thought they were in hell. They just didn't know how they were going to get through them. They didn't know, we can't get through a whole day like this. You know, it's just, you know, like this, you know, driving them nuts. And then when they finished, they somehow got through the day, and then they were just, you know, you could see them looking in the window at these people, and they were thinking, you know, so sad for those people. And that's their day. And, you know, throughout the world, the amount of people who have that sort of life, you know, if you compare that to someone like Jayaprakasa Maharaj, it's like he's living in, you know, like a god, really. So, yeah, certainly there's been, and you know, if you take in context personalities like Queen Kunti, if you actually take, you know, Crystal was on the planet for 125 years. Now, you know, there are certain intrigues that happened when the children were young, and then they tried to kill the Pandavas and what have you, and then they escaped and what have you, and there was the time they spent in the forest in Cognito and that, although, and then eventually they got their own Indraprastha, you know, their own city, which they ruled, and Krishna used to visit there, and Arjuna used to visit Krishna in Dwarka. I mean, Krishna killed Kamsa when he was about, 8 years old or something like that, and it was from about that period that he had his own city in Dwarka. And Arjuna used to visit him quite regularly, and Krishna used to visit. So, you know, it was towards the end of Krishna's pastimes, of course, that the Battle of Kurukshetra was there. Things had deteriorated, so there was always... So, you know, there was a few, certainly some standout moments in their childhood, and then towards the end, and there was always... But, you know, actually, if you take their whole life, and, you know, it's actually very, you know, very nice life, living as kshatriyas and rulers in Vedic times, and, you know, with the city was blessed by so many different demigods who awarded so many different mystic potencies, and, you know, the Sudama Assembly Hall, was that theirs? Was it where... Was that theirs or Krishna's? The assembly hall?
So I think they had a specific palace designed by...
Mayadandara or something.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was a very special.
Yeah.
So I think the main thing is the definition of what is a happy life.
Yeah.
Happy life is not that you can take the pilgrimage car and then it's home.
No,
but the thing is, all the activities centered to be from Krishna. That is. Yes, we, from a Krishna conscious point of view, we understand that. But if you tell someone that that just having faith in God is not enough, and you can see that because those who just have blind faith in the God, some of them are in extreme suffering.
Mm.
I would, like, I personally don't know how I'd be able to use that argument, because there are some devotees from an external perspective who are also being through extreme suffering. We understand philosophically that has brought them closer to Krishna, but from an external point of view, they've been through extreme suffering, because Krishna consciousness does not mean that external suffering goes away. It means that external suffering might remain, but internally you are becoming closer to Krishna, so that external suffering is not as severe.
Mm. Yeah, but in general, if you take the lives of devotees anywhere in the world, their position is usually far better than others. Although, as you're saying, some of them do go through some extreme difficulties, but, so, you know, if you take you know, if you take the lives of people generally, devotees generally, so, you know, so we take Australians. Devotees live, you know, quite a reasonable standard of life. In general, they tend to, you know, have a better standard of meals daily. They, you know, generally, because they maintain sattvic way of living, their occurrence of disease through poor nutrition and through poor you know, hygiene and what have you, is far less. Prabhupada, you know, quite often in his followers reduced the need for visiting doctors because he, to some degree, you know, unless it was needed, because he understood that actually if you live a good life, fresh air, you know, plenty of water, good sleep, regulated, generally celibate, not wasting your life energy, good food, a little bit of work, keep your mind active, you're not going to get as diseased as other people will commonly get diseased. So, among, you know, the general standard of devotees anywhere is usually better because they have better standards of living and they have a better understanding of how to exist in the world without becoming victimized by the material energy. And they have an understanding of how to live in the world and avoiding the modes of material nature. And they also have a better degree of tolerance, and above that they have prasadam, Krishna consciousness and good association. So, but, you know, if you take, for instance, if you take some religions where, you know, they consume huge proportions of meat, now, they're going to experience more health problems through that diet than those who are, you know, following a sattvic diet, because you know, I think just recently they admitted that meat is definitely linked with bowel cancer and what have you, red meat. They don't want people to, they don't want to advertise that because of the economy, but they're telling people that without doubt if you eat red meat, you know, it's going to increase by 30-40% or something like that, your chances of getting, you know, bowel cancer and some of the different things. You know, in some religious organisations, you know, smoking cigarettes and tobacco is a very acceptable behaviour, and also having, you know, certain amounts of alcohol, that's going to affect their health. You know, generally devotees don't have alcohol, and I mean, you know, generally devotees don't have it at all. They don't have alcohol, they don't have cigarettes and things like that. So their standard of health has got to be better. Now, in one sense, you know, what we do see is that many people become devotees, but in their previous lives, they or their parents in this life, you know, there's been some activities in mode of ignorance and what have you, and therefore they come into this world suffering. The suffering is not so much produced from their life as a devotee, but they become devotees and they have a set amount of suffering already due to them from their, not their devotional activities in previous life, but from their lack of devotion in a previous life, you see. Some, you know, but in general, if you take the life of a devotee, their standard of health, mind and happiness is better because their lifestyle is very sattvic. But you know, sometimes people are coming to devotional service fully, literally for the first time after many lifetimes of simple activities. But even those persons who have quite a severe, you know, instance of suffering in this life as a result of you know, lack of devotion in their previous lives, their situation within the devotional community is far better than someone who would have to endure that suffering outside of Krishna consciousness. But then, now, so you take that in general, and you know, where you have you know, exceptions to the rule of devotees, you know, exceptions where, you know, there are significant suffering. But In many countries, the entire country knows nothing but suffering. The entire population knows nothing but suffering. There's no, you know, it's an exception that one person out of millions actually is not caught up in extreme suffering, whole populations. So, you know, I don't think you could compare the two as being the same. You know, to take, you know, if you take the exceptions of devotees who are having, you know, extreme difficulty, and then consider, you know, those persons who may have come along to devotional service, or if you take a whole population who is suffering generation after generation, I don't think you can properly compare the two.
Then he was blind, you know. So do we call this that Krishna was serving him, you know? Krishna used to come and give him milk, you know. So we call him as a transcendental happiness or material suffering. How do you call the situation?
Transcendental happiness.
Blind. Krishna used to come and serve him milk and also. So how do you classify that?
There was another servant of Ramanujacharya, and he said, I used to see wherever I looked in this world as a place of misery. He said, now wherever I look, I just see, you know, that the Lord's mercy, which brings me great transcendental bliss. Like that. So, now, for instance, so that's another point that in many religious traditions, the concept of them being different from the body is not there. Okay? So, you know, with the even beginning devotees, they perceive I am a spirit soul, and they learn to disassociate themselves as far as possible from the mind, what happened, or the vexations of the mind, and the vexations of the body. In many religious traditions around the world, they're actually fully in the bodily concept of life. They associate themselves fully with the body and the bodily conception. So that, you know, as you were saying there, that transcendental difference is also, you can't really compare the two.
I was just thinking of, if you're talking to someone who's not Krishna conscious.
Yeah.
How would you be able to, like, how would you make the statement that just blind faith by some religion doesn't work? And you can see that because some of the people, I mean, following these faiths are undergoing extreme suffering.
Hmm.
I mean, there are Muslims in countries with extreme suffering, but then there are Muslims in Australia as well. Christians, they're in countries like America, Australia, UK, they're not undergoing their extreme suffering.
Yeah. That's why we have, therefore, we take reference from the scriptures that, you know, if we look at the life of, in the Vedic times, where Maharaj Yudhisthira, as described, Maharaj Yudhisthira ruled for 36 years? 1,000. Maharaj Yudhisthira? 36 years. 36 years. Yeah, Dhruta is Dhruta. But he, after the Battle of Kurukshetra. So, you know, that means that Krishna and Arjuna and the Pandavas would have been about 90 at the time of the Battle of Kurukshetra, right? Because he ruled for 36 years and then Krishna stayed for 125 and then they all departed. So if you go back from their 36 years, which is when the Battle of Kurukshetra was, it means that basically there would have been about 90, you know, at the time of the Battle of Kurukshetra. And Prabhupada says, you know, that at that time of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna was a great grandfather. You know, he had 10 sons, each of them had 10 sons, and they had 10 sons. So he would have been about, you know, 90 years old. So, you know, there's 36 years of Kunti's life, which is after the Battle of Kurukshetra. Battle of Kurukshetra, how long was that? 18 days. Of which she wasn't there, she was in the palace. But certainly she would have, there would have been grief for some days after. Krishna, you know, Krishna used to always watch out for Kunti and the others, and therefore he sent a crew there to keep a watch, and Vidura was there, and Hare Krishna, thank you. So, as I say, I think if you take even Queen Kunti's life, there are certainly some exceptional moments of great anxiety and grief, which, as we understood, even then she fixed her mind so much on Krishna that, you know, it was somewhat a transcendental experience. You know, then there are many years of living in Indraprastha with the Pandavas, away from Duryodhana and what have you, many, many years, you know, before that. I don't think you could take her whole life as a life of extreme suffering. I think, you know, if you actually look at her, she lived in the Vedic age when Krishna was there, in a beautiful palace, you know, with five sons who were, born from Indra and Vayu and what have you. And, you know, even though she lost her husband, she had five sons who were a manifestation of her husband in one sense, and who were very, very qualified. And then the association of Draupadi, who was practically like the goddess of fortune. So, you know, I don't think you could compare the two, you know, her life as one of being great suffering, and compare that to the average hypocritical religious person suffering, you know, their entire life, generation after generation, in this. Yeah, but you know, they're worlds apart. They very superficially you could compare them, but actually they're worlds apart. And as I say, then, you know, as we hear in the Vedic culture, when Krishna was present, and Maharaj Yudhisthira, even Duryodhana's rule, I think, you know, you once pointed out to me, you know, Duryodhana was actually considered quite a good ruler by, you know, people, a lot of people under him, you know, quite appreciated that, you know, he you know, because generally personalities like that, they, you know, they're into sense gratification and opulence and enjoying the good things of life. So even under his rule, you know, apart from the Pandavas who he, you know, was very envious of, but the majority of people under his rule were really well looked after according to Vedic principles. So, you know, when Krishna was present, and personalities like Arjuna and what have you, in that Vedic time, certainly there were some, you know, examples of a very difficult time. But it's nothing like the lack of religious principles that we have now, and the extreme suffering of whole nations, practically, generation after generation. So, you know, the comparison, it shows that something has really gone wrong. And you'd have to question what goes wrong. Well, if you compare the religious principles that existed in that time with Krishna to the religious principles that exist now, you say that's what's going wrong. But the difficulty, I can see your difficulty, that generally when you can understand that, but to make that, I'm making that comment here, because we can go through all those various comparisons properly and you can understand quite clearly what I'm talking about. I probably wouldn't use that example in a preaching context, that you know, you compare one religion to another, because it gets too complicated for most people. So you know, you're correct in that sense that I wouldn't bring that up as a solid point that they could easily digest, that if you see how people are living and they're supposed to be religious and yet they're really suffering, people would find that hard to understand because it's too complex for them. We can understand it because we've studied so many different things that we can compare. But yes, you know, it's not a strong preaching thing. It is if you've got time to speak to people, as we've done here. Yeah.
And in the future, it will be more suffering.
Yeah.
What is suffering now is nothing.
Yeah.
The future will be more.
And, you know, you've sat there and listened to me for, you know, 15 minutes. I mean, the average person you're talking to, you've got about 30 seconds to give them a couple of one-liners, and if you haven't convinced them, that you've lost their interest. And they've moved on to the football, you know, and the weather. Which is a second problem. So what do you think? She's moved on to a garden. No, God, what do you think?
Oh, well, I thought you said, what do you do?
No, what do you think?
I feel lonely because you have Christians who are in the Western, they eat meat, they have intoxication. They're living in the Western, wealthy society. You have Muslims who are on the extreme suffering in those kind of countries. Mm. But then you have Muslims who are living in America or in Australia who are not going to that country.
They're living in the future.
Okay, so in general, the answer to that is that generally they're all suffering. The rate of suffering, most people in the world will freely admit that even within a generation, the extent of anxiety and even the rate of illnesses and what have you seems to be increasing. So mental anxiety, depression, fear, and needing medication just to sleep and being nervous, you know, that is increasing in the world, all over the world. So let's just take the whole world as a planet. So to answer that question, that, you know, whether they're Christian, Muslim, or what have you, generally, the rate of suffering tends to be increasing. And the bounty of the earth seems to be decreasing. Now, you would expect that if the God consciousness was there properly and that the blessings of the Supreme Lord were there properly, it would be seen to be the opposite.
Okay.
All right?
My question.
Yeah.
They are saying that for them, even though they believe in God, there is no difference in suffering from them compared to the atheists.
That's right. On a world scale, you know, that's right. You know, there's very little difference. You know, you can't look at, you know, the average Christian, Muslim, what have you, and say that they're any better off than anyone else. Sometimes, in fact, the atheists and the demons seem to be doing a lot better. They flourish a lot better. But, you know, you would want to see some quite significant difference, wouldn't you? There's someone who's protected by God, but we see.
Because most of them are not really.
And in fact, the actual perception of the world is that religion is one of the greatest evils or problems that creates. Many people in the world actually believe that religion is the cause of most of the greatest problems that we face, and therefore John Lennon had his song, Imagine, you know, imagine no religion, only sky above us. So there's no heaven. So imagine how beautiful the world was if there's just no religion. Get rid of that problem, religion. You know, everyone, Above is no heaven, it's just the sky, like that. And then if you get rid of religion, everyone living in peace. It's this religion that's causing the war. That's what people think. In fact, they think that religious people, one, they create problems in this world, and two, they're missing out on all the good stuff.
No regulation.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes I see this, you see this bumper sticker on cars. It says, good girls go to heaven, and bad girls go everywhere. they're advertising, wake up, you've got this, very limited imaginary happiness, and we're doing what we please, and we're having a great old time. So, you know, people actually have these conceptions. So, people think that actually religion is the cause of suffering for the whole world, and especially for people who are religious, because they're deprived and they're creating problems for themselves and others. But you would expect that if someone was actually protected by God, it would be the exact reverse. That when you look at a religious person, that their life is blessed. You know? That, what do they say? Live a charmed life. You know, my parents always say that about me. They say, you lived a charmed life. I mean, I've had my share of difficulties and what have you, but they know that, you know, it's a charmed life. It's like there's something really special, and it's like you're just living by the grace of God, sort of thing. When I used to go to, I used to pop into the universities with my, help my daughters as they're doing assignments and, pay for their school books and what have you. Sometimes the friends would say to them after I left, your father's a millionaire? And she said, no. I said, it's his lifestyle. It's like, does he work? He pops in and out. He just does as he pleases. He goes here, he goes there. He's just like, he doesn't seem to have any pressure. Just wanders around doing what he likes. They have that impression, which I sort of do, I think. But, you would expect if there's some blessing that it's noticeable. But we're actually seeing the opposite. And my point is, if we're seeing the opposite, then let us question the religious principles which are being followed. You're not getting the blessings.
We had a subject that's known as moral science.
Mm.
You know what it says, like the moral goodness, like it says, do good to others,
yeah.
Don't tell lies.
Mm.
There is someone else higher than
yeah.
you. Talking about church, chapter about the Bible, there is someone higher than you. Some sacrifice has to be done. But unfortunately, this moral science is not there, they say.
Yeah.
Even in India also.
Yeah.
That is the first subject after the prayer. We used to go and have this half an hour subject, moral science.
Yeah.
Then it's not there even in India any longer. So what's the speaking of it? And that gives a very good thing. I don't know if you're away from the report.
Yeah. And that's right.
You know,
now,
yeah,
that, what they have now is sort of classes that, this is true, in some secondary schools and what have you, they have classes on, how not to drink too much alcohol and what happens if, you do get drunk or, and to moderate the amount of drugs that you take and, how to sleep around without getting pregnant and, there's some strange things that they teach.
Maybe it's
But anyway, here, you know, we started this conversation because here Sukadeva Goswami says that actually your destination is according to the particular modes of material nature, goodness, passion or ignorance that you have lived under, and then you will either, through the mode of ignorance, you get suffering almost like an animal in this life and the next. And, you know, goodness, you get, you know, pious activities, moral activities, you actually live a good life, both here and in the next. And, you know, passion, you get the mix. But, as you said, most people have no idea of that science. It is just, I have faith that what I'm doing, and that if I have a nice desire, that will, you know, if I want to, you know, if there is life after death, I'd like to go to heaven. You know, I'd like to. Doesn't matter how I'm living. I'm basically, look, I've done a few things I really had to do, but, you know, basically I'm a good person. And, you know, if someone, you know, has a wish and a desire, that is enough to get them to the next destination. That's generally what people think, even within religious organizations. So, you know, we see a phenomena, you know, within some of the so-called Muslim sort of offshoots, where they actually, you know, just that faith that, you know, if I kill so many innocent women and children in the shopping centre, it doesn't seem to be right, but, you know, the Supreme Leader has said it's a good thing, and, you know, my understanding is that, you know, I have a strong desire to go to heaven and be, you know, greeted by 72, you know, beautiful virgins, and I believe that, you know, I wish I will go there, and I believe that by this activity I will go there. And to them, that level of belief and faith is enough that, you know, they will perform all sorts of activities. Most people's understanding of the next destination in life is that shallow. That's the point. It is very, very shallow. There's hardly, you know, there's not much research into it. Even if they're part of a religious organization, they don't look into it too much. It's just the first thing that sort of sounds like what they want anyway, and that they can somehow say, oh, that's in the Bible, or that's here in the Quran. Anything that remotely supports in the vaguest way, in the most, you know, tenuous sort of relationship, their desire, I want this, and they find some little thing that they can, oh, I think that's close enough to support one another, that's enough. And that's the way.
How they think that they're feeling now, that's what they're saying.
Yeah. That is the nature of religion, philosophy, and the common people like that. Here, this information by Sukadeva Goswami, which is the same as the Bhagavad Gita, is very, very scientific. You live in the mode of goodness, passion, ignorance, you get a particular result. Like that. That science is what we're trying to help people to understand. And that is, in fact, how the laws of karma in the material world operate. And that science is basically unknown, you know, but extremely important. So that, you know, that is our contribution to the world. So you imagine if the average child, you know, was taught by their parents, you know, the parents said, look, you can wish to go to heaven, but if you're very naughty, you won't go there. You know, you see someone's taken birth as dogs, they must have been very, done some very bad things, someone's taken, you know, born in countries where there's a lot of suffering, and, you know, like that. You know, people take birth like that because of very bad karma. To get the good karma, you have to do good activities like that. Now, the average child has the intelligence to understand that and say, yes, okay, if I do good things and avoid bad things, then, you know, I get the, my future is very good. Like that. If that was taught in school and that was the general consensus, so it's not that difficult because, you know, in some countries they're teaching children from the age of 5, 6, 7, they give them a machine gun and sometimes they have it like a wooden machine gun and they teach them. You kill someone from America and you good person, you'll go to heaven. And you see the little kid, I hate Americans, I hate Westerners, I hate, you know, as the Indians say, the pinkies. It's on the phone one day. I was talking to my wife on the phone, she's asked some question, and my wife gave the answer, and the person really didn't like the answer. It was something, it was a conversation about vegetarianism or something. And he got really angry with her and called her a pinky. And then she goes, you better tell her. So then he's talking to me, and you know, I said to him, I gave him the same answer, and then he started insulting Sri Murthy. I said, that's my wife, be careful, please don't insult my wife, you know. And he got really angry, and then he started calling, you pinky! like that. I thought it was really funny. You know. I think it's like a big insult, you know, of course, I'm a pinky. You know, you can take children in Nazi Germany. You know, they used to have the little schoolboys, and they could sing in these beautiful angelic voices, like a choir, and they'd go through the streets. And it was propaganda about, you know, how the, you know, the Jews will all be killed, and you know, they're like animals, and we'll get rid of them. And little angel voices, and they're all dressed up and beautiful, you know. If you teach children something, if you can teach them that, why is it, you know, so difficult to think that you can take children and teach them, if you do good things, you'll have a good destination after life. If you have a, do bad things, you do have a bad destination. Causing harm to other living entities is one of the bad things. It causes people suffering. And helping others to reduce their difficulties in their life and helping them go back to God, etc. You know, very simple part of it, all the children's education around the world, that knowledge, but although it's so important, it's not there. So, you know, that's how Sukadeva Goswami opens, you know, this section on the hellish planets and answers Maharaj Brickett's question. And his answer is exactly what Krishna says in the Gita. And, you know, these things can be scientifically tested. So in other words, Krishna says, if a person does certain things, it's considered they're in the mode of tamaguna, and the result is that they will suffer, they'll become illusion, they'll become crazy. And if you see people who do those things, that's how they end up. People who do the sattvic things, they become peaceful, non-violent, happy, more healthy. And people who have the strong material desires, you know, and their happiness is connected to the result they're achieving, there's that mixed happiness and distress according to the result they're becoming. You can scientifically test in this life what he is saying, and therefore by that alone you can also verify that when the person dies, that as you're receiving that karma or material reaction in this life, that material reaction should follow, you know, in the afterlife as well. So this here is not a matter of faith, but it's actually scientifically verifiable. And the proof of that is literally this Krishna consciousness movement, because, you know, Prabhupada is very proud of saying that, you know, he picked up, you know, hippies and people off the street who were, you know, somewhat a bit greyish in their complexion, and you know, morose, and you know, a bit dirty, and poor hygiene, and you know, depressed and hopeless condition, lost their enthusiasm, and he picked them up and they become, you know, bright faced and clean and enthusiastic and intelligent and very industrious and very expert in so many different things like that. So, you know, these things are verifiable. What's that?
That these devotees
will get
over me.
That what?
Mm-hmm. That these devotees, disciples of me, by their
emotions
alone, they will
get over me. Yeah, that, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that becomes so relevant.
I know that.
Yeah, yeah. But he is, it's also a very, you know, a very good endorsement, isn't it? And that's the quality of these disciples. Yeah, it is. Yeah, he was. Anyway, so that's the opening. Any more questions or comments on that? Yeah, that's good. Sometimes we can read over these verses and not quite understand their significance. But actually, if we just took those few verses and made sure within the education of every child in this world, they understood how the actions and the modes of material nature affect their life in this life and the next, that the world will be in far better place than just people having some fanciful thought and wish within their head and thinking that the reality will manifest from that. So, he says, King Parikit inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, "My dear Lord, are the hellish regions outside the universe, within the covering of the universe, or in different places of this planet?" The great sage Sukadeva Goswami answered. Who else could answer that question? You know? "All the hellish planets are situated in the intermediate space between the three worlds and the Garbhodaka ocean. They lie on the southern side of the universe beneath Bhumandala and slightly above the water of the Garbhodaka ocean. Pitraloka is also located in this region between the Garbhodaka ocean and the lower planetary systems. All the residents of Pitraloka, headed by Agnisvata, meditate in great samadhi on the Supreme Personality of Godhead and always wish their families well." So it's a very pious place to go, Pitraloka. So it's situated in that region, similar to where the hellish planets are, but it's not part of the hellish region. "The king of the Pitas is Yamaraj, the very powerful son of the sun god. He resides in Pitraloka with his personal assistants, and while abiding by the rules and regulations set down by the Supreme Lord, has his agents, the Yamaduta, bring all the sinful men to him immediately upon their death. After bringing them within his jurisdiction, he properly judges them according to their specific sinful activities and sends them to one of the many hellish planets for suitable punishments." So of course we know that Yamaraj is one of the Mahajans, very, very significant person within the universe, and he resides there in Pitraloka, so very auspicious to go to that place where one of the Mahajans resides and worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead. "Some authorities say that there is a total of 21 hellish planets, and some say 28. My dear King, I shall outline all of them according to the different names, forms, and symptoms. The names of the different hells are as follows: Tamisra, Under Tamisra, Rarava, Maharava, Kumbhipaka, Kalasutra, Asipatravan, Sukaramukha, Andakupa, Krimibhojana, Sandamsa, Taptasurmi, Vajrakantaka, Salmali, Vaitarani, Puyoda, Panaroda, Vishasan, Lalabhaksa, Salamejidana, Avichi, Ayapana, Sarakadama, Rakshogana Bhojana, Shuloptota, Dandasukha, Avatanirodhana, Parivatana, and Suchimukha. All these planets are meant for punishing the living entities. My dear King, a person who appropriates another's legitimate wife, children or money is arrested at the time of death by the fierce Yamadutas who bind him with rope, the rope of time, and forcibly throw him into the hellish planet known as Tamisra. On this very dark planet, the sinful man is chastised by the Yamadutas, who beat and rebuke him. So it's very dark there. He is starved and he is given no water to drink. Thus the wrathful assistance of Yamaraj causes him severe suffering, and sometimes he faints from their chastisement. Because, you know, as we're reading these, we understand that many of these hellish punishments also, as well as being punishment, they also condition one to the life one will experience when they do take birth again, even among the humans, or sometimes amongst animals. So, you know, they're forced to live in a dark and fearful sort of a place, starved, no water to drink, like desert sort of, there are a lot of places on the world like this too, isn't it? You know, lack of food, lack of water. I think the statistic is 140 children a day, I think it is, die from a lack of proper drinking water. So you can imagine, you know, around the world that problem, how big that problem is. 140 a day. Yeah.
My mother actually had a question when she read this section. Mm. When people are punished in hell, why is they, I mean, they've already undergone their punishment, why do they suffer again when they take another birth?
Yeah. It depends upon the severity of their crime. So we heard in the beginning that those who commit these sinful activities in ignorance or madness, it's the less severe. So they may experience some suffering there for some time, and then they may actually, that may be enough. Those who know the difference between right and wrong and who commit these sinful activities, it is more severe. They may have to undergo this sort of suffering in the hellish condition, and then they may take birth in a human form in a similar suffering condition like that. Some who are atheistic, they're purposely, you know, committing evil activities. Their punishment is most severe, and of course, according to those levels, then the how many times they commit that, and the you know, the severity of the sinful activity that they're doing, you know, someone takes someone's wife, someone can take the wife of a brahmana, someone can take the wife of a king, someone can take the wife of a person who is blind and severely dependent upon the wife. So there's different levels of severity, and therefore that person, you know, in some scriptures where it describes these hellish planets, what happens, they go to these hellish planets, then they take birth as a dog, a rat, an owl, so that there may be five or six different animal species they take birth in these different, difficult, dark and, you know, harsh conditions, restricted conditions, and then they take birth as a human in difficult conditions. So, does that answer your questions? You see what I mean? So that for some it is enough, and for others there may be actually further punishment, you know, after that hellish planet as well.
But we are told that whatever we do, suppose if I do something to somebody, I have to take that back. That person will again take birth and give it back.
Mm.
That's the general rule that the karma will be. Okay, you will get it back.
Mm.
But then I go to the hellish planet, I get a punishment there, then I come birth, have birth, then we also have to take birth, or he or she, and then they have to pay me back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
What happens is that not everyone actually goes to the boat of Yamaraj. The boat of Yamaraj is where there's an excess of sinful reactions, and therefore, you know, what appears to be like eternity, but actually, in between the next birth, it, you know, they have actually been severely punished for what they feel like has been many hundreds of lifetimes, because of the it's not, you know, unless they experience that massive burning up of and punishment for sinful reactions, you know, it would take just too many lifetimes, you know. So not everyone actually goes to the abode of Yamaraj for going to the hellish planets. In other words, they may go to the abode of Yamaraj and then take birth, as you say, and receive the punishment that, oh, I stole from them, and Yamaraj gives them another human birth and someone steals from them. Not everyone goes to the hellish planets. That's for quite an excess of sinful activities.
They also go to the same hellish planet, even though they are not aware.
Yeah.
They don't want to know, they're not aware, but still they have to go to the hellish planet, they have to.
Yeah, so... you know, when they go to the hellish planets, then... you know, when they're about to be beaten, you know, the Muslims may say, oh, can you please not beat me with the same stick that you beat the Christian with? So you know, they'll accommodate them somehow. But basically when you're getting beaten by the Yamadutas, or your so-called mental concoctions that exist up here, don't last. And if you're being starved, you're given no water to drink, and then, you know, at some point after long duration, you're given water to drink, you won't ask the question, you know, has this water been touched by a non-Muslim or a non-Hindu, or you'll just, you know, you drink it even if you drink it even if it's been urinated in by a donkey, or just touched by someone from another religion. In fact, you know, Napoleon, to give you an example of how, you know, sometimes people are sinful and then they take birth. Napoleon, when they finally captured him and they put him in exile on this little island, so the British, when he asked for water, they would actually give him donkey urine. And there was nothing he could do about it. He just had to drink. I mean, they drove him mad. He gradually went completely mad. but you know, extreme. They made the last part of his life extreme suffering. You know, just this mental torture. You know, here's someone. What's that? Well, you know, he had caused so much suffering. You know, and you know, in one sense, some people saw him as a great conqueror, and others saw him as a great, you know, thief and raider and pillager and, you know, murderer. And you know, so many people suffered as a result of him trying to fulfil his own ambitions, which didn't even really benefit his own country, from what I understand. Even his, you know, no one really benefited. But
but it's fully left something to the need. Not only left something in the system.
They're preparing him for the hellish planets.
Training.
Some training.
The position is that he has paid off
a little. Not much. The man.
Even they say that if a person is murdered and he is judged in the court and
For that one murder. If he's murdered several people,
yes,
then he
for
has.
That,
yeah.
For that particular.
Yeah.
No, to that extent, it is.
Yeah.
Not the whole evening.
Yeah. So you can imagine how many thousands or millions of people that suffered as a result of, you know, his lust and greed and violence. So, you know, there's some preparing him for his next life in the hellish regions. And from the hellish regions, that would prepare, you know, him for his next life, which would be, you know, some great suffering as well for some lifetimes. You know, there was one Prime Minister of India, and one astrologer said that from his understanding, because you can actually see where a person goes after they die. You know, that's there in a person's astrological chart. And he said that his understanding was that he became a dog somewhere in some Scandinavian country.
Nehru.
Nehru, yeah. And Prabhupada, you know, said, of course, we can't prove that, but it sounded feasible because of, you know, what he understood in Nehru. Yeah. In everyone's chart, you can actually see that if they just follow the normal course of their destiny, and they've not really, you know, without some major intervention, that there'll be certain birth, a certain type of death, and a certain destination after death. Yeah.
So does it apply to then the life events that are meant to occur?
Then their destination is changed, you know. So someone may be actually destined to, you know, have a quite a severe suffering type of a death, and also to go to the hellish regions after death, and that can all be changed, even though it's here on the chart by devotional service. And as we said, sometimes a person's karma is set out for many lifetimes. You know, they may go to the hellish planets, and then, you know, they've got five or six lifetimes which are just fixed up. You know, and they can be fixed up, you know, they can be fixed up at, pretty much there's no real chance of intervention. You know, they just take birth somewhere. You know, there are different countries in the world where devotees just can't go, nor the books, nor Krishna consciousness like that. And it may be some generations. So some of the, you know, people who are born there, basically their destiny is fixed up and no one's going to change it, you know, for some And so Krishna can arrange that. And some living entities are destined to just repeatedly die within the womb. So there's no chance for within their lifetime of getting some, you know, change of their destiny. They take birth in the womb. Yeah, you know, it's a situation of very sinful activity where a person is forced to live in you know, just complete restriction, miserable, you know, very uncomfortable, even painful situation, and then a, you know, a very fearful you know, death without any means of protection, and just to experience that again and again, it's you know, different levels of suffering. So this verse number 9, the destination of a person who slyly cheats another man and enjoys his wife and children is the hell known as Antatamisra. There his condition is exactly like that of a tree being chopped at its roots. Even before reaching Antatamisra, the simple living being is subjected to various extreme miseries. These afflictions are so severe that he loses his intelligence and sight. It is for this reason that learned sages call this hell Antatamisra. So, you know, some of them sound a bit more severe than others, don't they? There's Tamisra and there's Antatamisra. Antatamisra sounds worse. A person who accepts his body as his self works very hard day and night for money to maintain his own body and the bodies of his wife and children. While working to maintain himself and his family, he may commit violence against other living entities. Such a person is forced to give up his body and his family at the time of death. When he suffers a reaction for his envy of other creatures by being thrown into the hell called Rorava. In this life, an envious person commits violent acts. So, you know, you can imagine butchers and, you know, so many different personalities. And in this life, an envious person, you imagine those people, you know, they go to a seafood restaurant and they eat the crayfish. And they take the crayfish, you know, live out of the water and, you know, people select, oh yes, I'll have this one like that. And they pick them up and they just drop them into the boiling water like that. And you know, there's this squealy sort of a sound like that. You know. But, and they do that for a living day in, day out. You know, in some of the Asian countries, you go there and, you know, people eat, you know, they want monkey's brains. You know, and you know, monkey hand soup and all sorts of crazy things, and they will just freshly kill that animal in the marketplace on the spot and cook it up. In this life, an envious person commits violent acts against many living entities. Therefore, after his death, when he is taken to hell by Yamaraj, those living entities who were hurt by him appear as animals called Rurus to inflict very severe pain upon him. Learned scholars call this hell Rurova. Not generally seen in this world, the Ruru is more envious than a snake. So, those living entities, but they appear as a type of animal called a Ruru. and they're obviously a very, you know, you imagine if you're in the forest and you're a pack of wolves, you know, if you injured yourself and you can't run, and a pack of wolves comes and they just start biting at you and ripping the flesh, and they all start fighting at you and just ripping the, you know, just eating alive. In fact, I think it might have been the Vikings, you know, it was one of the punishments that they would give a person. They would dress them up in a skin from a freshly killed animal. So the skin had some bits of meat and blood and what have you, and then they just tie him to a tree in the forest. And gradually just the various animals in the forest would just devour him alive like that. You know. So that was, you know, one of the... So even here, even in this world, actually it's one of the punishments that, you know, they do. So it's not surprising that there's a place where they do this. Punishment, and there are also, you know, in some places they bury people in the sand out in the desert and they let the snakes and things come and kill them, you know, or ants, you know, they let the ants kill them. So many different things. Some places they drop these insects into the ears which fall into their brain and things. You know, so many different things, even in this world, you know. Punishment in the hell called Mahavirodha is compulsory for a person who maintains his own body by hurting others. In this hell, rural animals known as Kravyada torment him and eat his flesh. For the maintenance of their bodies and for the satisfaction of their tongues, cruel persons cook poor animals and birds alive. We were just talking about that.
So it says in the hellish planet they eat flesh, they didn't give a new body.
Yeah. Every they go through that death, and then next thing they're there, and it's all happening again. They're killed again and again and again in the same way.
So they have the body at that time?
Yeah, it's like a, you know, somewhat subtle body.
It's not yet a big body,
yeah.
But
that is their experience, that the flesh is, you know, being eaten from their body. I mean, you know, even if you dreamt that, a nightmare, the animals were eating your flesh, you would be absolutely going mad, you know. And if you had that nightmare even a couple of times a week on a regular basis, it would drive you nuts. So, you know, your life would be so much bigger, just like that, you know. But I'm sure their ability to create this reality, this virtual reality for them is, I'm sure Yamaraj is up to the task.
Still they're forgetting.
Yeah, it's the impression is there. That, you know, so, in one sense, it's a fresh enough experience each time it happens that the terror, if anything, becomes worse and worse. You know, for instance, sometimes you go to the dentist, you know. And the dentist gets the needle and they stick it right in the gum, you know. And then he goes, I'm just going to have to do the other side. You know, it doesn't get any better because you've just had one that, oh, okay, well, I've just experienced that. You're sort of or fearing the next one even worse. That's why when children get their ears pierced, it's good to do them both at the same time. You know, because the fear of the next one getting done, if you do one, and then the next one, that fear here comes. For the maintenance of their bodies and the satisfaction of their tongues, cruel persons cook poor animals and birds alive. such person condemned by condemned even by man-eaters. So at least man-eaters tend to kill you and then eat you. So even they're thinking, oh, that's off. You know, you're not even gonna, you're gonna cook them alive. In the next lives, they're carried by the Yamadutas to the hell known as Kumbhipaka, where they're cooked in boiling oil. Boiling oil is worse than boiling water because, you know, it sticks to you like that. The oil sticks to you. You know, whereas the water tends to, you know, run off, the oil just sort of clings onto your body. You know, it's like that. It's the worst type of a burn. The killer of a brahmana is put into the hell known as Kala Sutra, which it has a circumference of 80,000 miles and which is made entirely of copper. 80,000 miles. How many sinful people would they accommodate? It's not like they've got a couple of hundred prison cells. 80,000 miles worth of which is made entirely of copper. Heated from below by fire and from above by the scorching sun. Now you imagine being in the middle of that. Even the distance of it would scare the hell out of you. That, you know, you're somewhere there and as far as you can see, there's just no way off. You know, like sometimes, you know, there's some terrible thing that you can see the end of it somewhere, you know. But when there's no end, it just makes that suffering more. Heated from below by fire, from above by the scorching sun, the copper surface of this planet is extremely hot. Thus the murderer of a brahmana suffers from... So, you know, that's interesting. It's heated above by the scorching sun. Now, of course, we understand that the sun's above the mandala, don't we?
And
yeah,
that,
you know, yeah. So, you know... therefore, you can see that some aspects of this, you know, would appear to be virtual, you know, like a virtual reality, I think.
Actually, another question I have. The doctrine in Spanish, how do we have plants when there's no sun? Or is it something that the plant is not special to you, just the light
of you?
Well, I think they still have, even in caves and things, they still have.
Even in the underground, deep inside the ocean.
Yeah.
And then that plants grow by taking the nutrition from all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they need sunlight or water. So
there's
different
types of things. Yeah. That's right, yeah. In other words, you know, you can have a system where, you know, you've got some plants, some living entities thriving off the sunlight, and then, you know, their byproducts, you know, can feed those that don't have sunlight. And in that way they're deriving the nutrient from the sun second hand. Thus the murderer of a brahmana suffers from being burned both internally and externally. Internally he is burning with hunger and thirst, and externally he is burning from the scorching heat of the sun and the fire beneath the copper surface. Therefore he sometimes lies down, sometimes sits, sometimes stands up and sometimes runs here and there. He must suffer in this way for as many thousands of years as there are hairs on the body of an animal. Thousands of years. That's extreme, isn't it? You know, you think, oh, you know, you're being tortured for a couple of hours, torture. You know, you're pretty much done.
Maybe this is not for Kali Yuga, I think.
Eh?
Maybe Father Yuga, I think. Because in Kali Yuga,
now,
how can
that happen?
Kali Yuga, basically, everyone is
waiting,
waiting.
Yeah.
Other than the devotees.
Yeah. this copper circumference is 80,000 miles, so it can take a lot of people. they're expecting, you know, big crowd. Yeah. What they say is the path to hell is wide and, you know, paved in gold.
Yes, other yogas, they maybe, you know, there's a less number of people, mm-hmm. or something,
if a person deviates from the path of Vedas in the absence of an emergency, the servants of Yamaraj put him into the hell called Sipatchavan, where they beat him with whips. When he runs hither and thither, fleeing from the extreme pain, on all sides he runs into palm trees and leaves like sharpened swords. Thus injured all over his body and fainting at every step, he cries out, "Oh, what shall I do now? How shall I be saved?" This is how one suffers who deviates from the accepted religious principles. So you'd sort of be thinking, I'll just stay in the one spot and get whipped. But the pain makes you think, no, I'll run. And if you run, it's worse than staying in the one spot. So you think, I'll stay in the one spot.
But during the pain, if you can't Hare Krishna, you will be able to do.
Well, there are, you know, different pastimes where people have liberated everyone in hell. You know. In his next life, a sinful king or governmental representative who punishes an innocent person or who inflicts corporal punishment upon a brahmana is taken by the Yamadutas to the hell named Sukaramukha, where the most powerful assistants of Yamaraj crush him exactly as one crushes sugar cane to squeeze out the juice. The sinful living entity cries very pitiably and faints, just like an innocent man undergoing punishment. This is a result of punishing a faultless person. So, you know, the extreme, you know, the weight of authority coming down on you, you know, so they feel the weight of the being crushed. Ivan the Terrible. You ever heard of Ivan the Terrible? He used to love to impale people, and so you know they would have like large poles that would gradually get thinner and sharper, and then they would, you know, push it through the anus right through, and then they just stand the pole up and gradually the weight of their body would just, you know, they would slide down the pole like that. And he would sit there, impaling, yeah, he would sit there and eat his meal and enjoy the show. So he'd have about 20, 30, 50 people being impaled like that. And sometimes he would look around to his servants who were serving the meal. And if they showed any displeasure as to what he did, he impaled them. So that's it. Making an innocent person suffer. Is that like that? Oh, don't like it? Guards. But, you know, these hellish punishments, now, you know, they seem quite unbelievable. We see terrible things here. You know, when he was Ivan was terrible. There were different armies coming to kill him, right? And what happened was he decided that he would terrify them so that they wouldn't even enter his kingdom because he was outnumbered thousands and thousands of one. So what he did was he impaled so many people that right around the borders of his country, when the soldiers come in, as far as they could go and as far as they could see, were just impaled. His citizens were just impaled. Yeah, and they said to themselves, if he does this to his own citizens, what's he going to do to us if we attack him? And they just left. Okay. You know, so... It's a long pole And very, yeah, very sharp at the end. I'll give you some more description. But, yeah. I mean, the impalement itself is very painful, but, you know, what happens is the weight of your body gradually increases the pain. Yeah. Impalement, yeah. It just gets worse until you actually die. You know, death is a blessing. So, you know, you see here, the sinful living entity cries very pitifully. Now, you can imagine there are people like Ivan the Terrible who are, you know, suffering these, you know, very severe punishments.
How would they capture?
What's that?
How would they capture? How would they?
I'm not sure. I can't remember the. Anyway, that's just a tip of the iceberg of what he did. By the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, low-grade living beings like bugs and mosquitoes suck the blood of human beings and other animals. Such low-grade living beings like bugs and suck the blood of human beings and other animals. Such insignificant creatures are unaware that their bites are painful to the human being. However, first-class human beings, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, are developed in consciousness and therefore they know how painful it is to be killed. A human being endowed with knowledge certainly commits sin if he kills or torments insignificant creatures who have no discrimination. The Supreme Lord punishes such a man by putting him into the hell known as Antakupa, where he is attacked by all the birds and beasts, reptiles, mosquitoes, lice, worms, flies and any other creatures he tormented during his life. They attack him from all sides, robbing him of the pleasure of sleep. Unable to rest, he constantly wanders about in the darkness. Thus in Antakupa, his suffering is just like that of creature in the lower species. These days, for instance, mosquitoes. Some of the mosquitoes, if they bite you, they cause think there's Ross River fever and so many different things. You heard that, of that? Yeah. You know, you want to prevent it at all. You know. There's white-tailed spiders and, you know. You do need to, if they're going to attack you and possibly put your life in jeopardy, cause you extreme, you know, unreasonable suffering, then yes, you may have to prevent that, you know, at all measures, you know. And therefore, like if a snake's going to bite you and you kill a snake, then, you know, it's, you know, it says even saintly persons consider that acceptable. But, so, you know, a little discretion, discrimination is there.
It's not necessary that all of these people are going to cause malaria, but it's just that you can't be peaceful without doing something about the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
They won't let you sleep, they won't let you do anything.
So, you know, in general, you know, to get things like mosquito nets, you know, in Australia they have the hats with the corks. But, yes, it is...
So in India they have something called a mosquito bat.
Mosquito...
Bat. An electric bat.
Yeah.
And if you have mosquitoes around you or on the before going to sleep, for example, you just take the bat and you put it all over the bed. electric, so it touches, it gives a small electric shock.
Right, and kills it. Okay, yeah.
So you do that all over the bed, mosquito comes to bite you, you can do that to the mosquito.
Right.
And it's regularly used, not electric shock.
Right.
Not necessarily that they go all the way to find mosquitoes
to
kill them, but just on the bed or on the body. Just in the curtains, because if it's in the room, then it will come and bite you when you're sleeping.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's... you know, where there's an element of danger, disease, or what have you, have to be really careful. Where there is just an annoyance, you know, then we have to be, I guess, a little bit more careful. I mean, you know, if we think, well, there's no way that this creature is going to cause me any illness at all, it's not going to, you know, it's just going to annoy me while I'm asleep. I guess we have to be. Somewhat mindful. But let's say you don't sleep that night, and the next day you're doing a 300-mile drive, and you fall asleep at the wheel and you kill yourself. You know, so there's a risk factor there, isn't it? You know, let's say if you don't get some sleep, a few hours sleep, and they're going to keep you awake, and you've got to make that drive, and you're in the service of Krishna, then, you know, perhaps there's, you know, so...
I mean, you can avoid it by putting water mask or something, but that's putting a chemical queen on your body every day.
Yeah, yeah, which can kill you. And these days, they're totally safe, and you find out 5 years later it wasn't. So, in general, we try to discriminate. So, for instance, we eat vegetables which are actually living. You know, some of them actually, like you take a carrot out of the ground, or you know, you take some plants you take out of the ground, and you actually, that's the end of their life when you do that, and then you cook them and eat them, isn't it? So, you know, so so you know, it's not possible to live in this world without killing something, but we have to understand that we have to reduce that to the very, very minimum understanding that that is a living being that we're causing suffering. And even when sometimes, you know, it is there, we tend to at least acknowledge that I really don't like the fact of having to kill anything. Sometimes it's unavoidable, and what have you. So that, you know, at least the consciousness must be there. But therefore, at least one should be engaged in Krishna consciousness and try and, you know, set a reasonable example that people will not think you're overly fanatical, and something that people in general can, you know, follow. But yeah, it takes a lot of intelligence. But look, there's a few other descriptions there of the hellish planets. I'm going to let you read that, a little bedtime story. Yeah, like that. Aye? Yeah, you can, if anyone has children or grandchildren, you can read it to them. Yeah, so I'll let you do that, but, and then, Sukadeva Goswami finished off this chapter, and we studied this last time in our exam, that, you know, the process of avoiding that, of course, is becoming, herein lies the answer to your question, you know, that really, those last verses where Sukadeva Goswami is saying, you know, take the Krishna consciousness and teach others Krishna consciousness. And if that is the basis of your life, and the minimum, you know, problem that we cause to other living entities within the course of developing Krishna consciousness and preaching Krishna consciousness will save us from that suffering. That's the answer to that question. Yeah. But don't take advantage of it in the sense that, oh, you know, I chant Hare Krishna and I don't have to go to hell, so I'll just go around swatting everything that crawls past. All right then, so we'll leave it there. And so when do I see you again? Tomorrow.
You're not making this meeting next week?
Now, we want to do chapters, the part of 17, 18 and 19. I'd say not next week, and the week after that is Govardhan Puja, but after that we should meet again. Yeah, so next week will be what, 7th or something, Govardhan Puja 14, so on the 21st we'll come back and we'll go through those three chapters, you know, all those nice prayers and that, like that, yeah. Right.
And
can we do one shloka at a time? Yeah, certainly. So what I'll do is I'll bring the different sheets to be able to mark you off. And I think some of you have also got the sheets with your own record of it.
If
you,
yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is that when I come back, I've got all your results. Everyone passed the exam. I can give you exact results, but they're all up in, you know, 17, most about 18, 19, 20, you know, everyone did really well. What's that? Presentation?
Yeah.
Yeah, strange enough, the men got 85%.
Ooh.
And the women got 85%. Yeah. I thought they were good, you know, I thought we covered diagnosis. But I'll bring along actually a complete list of everything and you can have a look at it and compare it with what you've got. And then, you know, between now and when we begin again, the actual lessons in, you know, February, if there are things that you want to catch up, maybe we'll try and, you know, have a little bit where we sort of make arrangements anyway to people who've got exams to do and essays and things.
And so, like, when you're meeting on November 21st, will you bring that sheet where you put all the marks by the data so that we can
see
which one
we have? Yeah, I will. Yeah, I'll have all of that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.